I'd rather let Lorenzo speak for himself when it comes to the bio. If you buy a copy of that, the Pam copy in the back of the bio, I think you wrote that in. Well, there's a lot of ways. So there's a lot of other pamphlets over here that all of the proceeds are going to go to publishing a new edition of Anarchism and the Black Revolution. And that's all I'm really going to say. Lorenzo Kubota.
Unfortunately, where's the
mic? It's right there.
I don't can everybody hear what I'm saying? Okay. Hopefully, I've got some kind of voice. It's cold or whatever. And it's sort of been giving me problems. But anyway, as long as you can hear me, ain't that many people here anyway. But I'm thankful for whoever is here. We're close. We're in the. I am an organizer originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I've been organizing my whole damn life. And probably has been ever since I've been 10 years old. I started out organizing in 1960 around the sit-in protests in the South. As I got more experienced and got older, I started working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Tennessee and in Georgia. Later years, when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee merged with the Black Panther Party in 1967, I became a member of the Black Panther Party and started working all over the South. As you might well expect, I was one of the persons who was repressed by the government because the government was opposed to the organizing of the Black Panther Party and the Black Power Movement, which erupted in the late 1960s. Their whole thing was that they assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King, assassinated Malcolm X leadership of both of the Civil Rights Wing and the Black Power Wing of the movement. And they began to repress the Black Panther Party with really some awesome brutality and some terribly subversive activities, including a political assassination, framing people in prison. Some people have been in prison as a result of their membership of the Black Panther Party for the last 30 years. They're in prison to this day, over 30 years. People who have been exiled, there are people who can't come back to the United States because they face criminal charges. They've been exiled. We don't know exactly how many. I know personally of 25 people. There may be others, I don't know. But the point is that this government has repressed political activists for years. And my first taste of imprisonment, and to really see how the prison system worked, came as a result of my being an actual political prisoner or being an actual prisoner myself. In the federal system, that's up at that water. Is that water at? In the federal prison system, myself. Now I was sentenced to two life terms in 1969. Thank you for hijacking a plane to Cuba. I'm seeking political asylum. I was being railroaded in Tennessee as a result of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. He was killed in April '68. And a rebellion broke out in several cities in Tennessee. The leadership of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the national leadership as it was then, were indicted, in fact, in Nashville, Tennessee, for a so-called riot, the police claimed, that took place on the campus of Tennessee State University, and also indicted under the state equivalent of a treason act, an insurgency act. And in Chattanooga, I was investigated by something called the Black Power Grand Jury, which is the Hamilton County Grand Jury, investigating the Black Power Movement in Tennessee. And there had been a rebellion after Dr. King had been killed, and the youth in Chattanooga had actually gotten arms and had taken over the city center and was shooting it out with the police. And this scared these white folks, these rednecks down there to death. And they started this investigation. And there's an individual who comes from Chattanooga, Willie Ricks. He's somebody who's never really been given his due. He's been called the best organizer, bar none, of this whole civil rights period. All the political formations that was existing at the time, the Kings, Southern Christian Leadership Council, SNCC, CORE, all the groups that did organizing, civil rights groups did organizing in the South at that time, recognized that Ricks was the best of the organizers, grassroots organizer. Part of this is because he was somebody who wasn't a middle class kid. You know, he came from poverty. He was somebody who was from a working class family, had been in the street, grew up in the street, you know, and could relate to poor people. Whereas many of the people who were in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, good people, but they came from the middle class. They came out of college campuses and so forth. And those privileges kind of like put a barrier between them and these poor people in the South. And that was one of the things that had to be overcome. So the training, we were able to try to overcome that. But Ricks was the one who actually came up with the concept of black power. And Ricks, of course, he's not known for that, you know, so Carmichael and others will give him credit for it, but he was the one that actually came up with it. And he got it from actually working in the community. He said when he would go and talk to people and mention black power, they'd go to screaming, black power, black power. And they, you know, have these long-lasting discussions where it led him to believe and understand that people had come to a new consciousness. They were not trying just to get civil rights reforms or the right to vote and all this sort of stuff, but they were actually wanted liberation. Which is the word we use this today, it, you know, is another term name, but black power was the terminology. And it was also used by, ultimately used by the youth in northern cities when they would rebel against police brutality, they would holler, black power, and, you know, burn the city down. Well, anyway, all this stuff was going on at this time, and the authorities to repress it started holding grand juries. Now, the federal government had its own secret police agencies. Not some people know about COINTELPRO, but there were many others. The CIA had Operation Chaos. The Internal Revenue Service had its own intelligence division. Just about every agency of the federal government had its own intelligence division, and most of them were directed at the black movement in this country at that phase. And ultimately, the pressure from the government destroyed the black power movement. Many people were in prison. Contemporaneously with that, the repression of the anti-war movement, the repression of the Latino liberation movement, you know, with the Brown Beret in New York, you know, the Puerto Rican Nationalist Movement, all these organizations that were contemporaneous with the Black Panther Party were crushed. Most of the leadership put in prison, many people were killed or driven out of the country. So when we converged inside the prison system, in the period that we converged inside the prison system, you had all these activists inside the prisons. And effectively what we did is took over the prison system. Of course, this became apparent in a really serious way with the Attica Rebellion. Then the whole world knew what was going on. But before that happened, they had been organizing underground by prisoners, black prisoners especially, to bring together a radical movement, people who had been ideologically educated, people who had been inspired by the struggles that was going on in the street. It affected, you know, the prisoners as well. And, you know, there's always this belief that, especially this period, that poor people or people who are from the lower classes can't learn, you know, that they can't get very complicated political theories. They can't pick it up. They can't deal with it. And what was proven, you know, with the Attica Rebellion, with ultimately the Black Panther Party and other movements that came and had black working class youth, you know, in the lead of those movements, was that not only could they pick it up, they could articulate it to the people of the world. They could put it out there better than the old socialist movement had been trying to put it out there for ever since they've been here, you know. And it was very threatening to the state. And one of the things that happened when the activists who would come off the streets linked up with the convicts and radicalized the convict population, and they lost control of the prison system, then they came with these control unit prisons, as they first called them, in Marion, Illinois. The first experiment, however, was in a so-called prison hospital, federal prison hospital in Springfield, Missouri. Now, I'm telling you all this stuff so that you can get a grasp on why things are the way they are with the prison system this massive prison system and all this stuff. You know, we'll get to all that. They had started what they call behavior modification in Springfield, Missouri, and they were experimenting with prisons. They were forcing prisoners to take lobotomies. And a lobotomy is a surgical operation or procedure where they remove the frontal lobes of your brain. And this cripples you. I mean, I've seen people just turn into animals like that. And I was very close to having that happen to me. You know, and the federal government started this in their prisons first before the states did. They started doing it first. And they would have prisoners shipped in from all over the country. You know, whoever you might get sentenced here in New York for a state crime, and they'd have you, if you're, especially if you're an activist, and they would have you shipped to Illinois or somewhere, you know, where Marion was located. And there, they would experiment on you, you know. And all of this came to a head. We were able to build, I was locked up in this so-called medical center. And we were able to get the word out into the streets about what was happening and build a outside support network. And with this outside support network, we were then able to shut it down and expose it to the people of the world. Well, as these things develop, as they go, while we shut it down in Missouri, they opened up the federal prison in Marion, Illinois, 1973. They opened up this control unit, as they call it, which was a concentration camp within a prison. Marion, Illinois at that time was the tightest security prison in the world. And this H block, as it was known, was used to take some of these theories of behavior modification along with long-term confinement and use that as a way to break political prisoners, break someone that they felt was an activist. And they would keep you confined years on end. It was like a never-ending, you might, if you got 20 years, you might be in there 20 years. You didn't know, you know. And some people cracked in there. When I was in that place during that time, I know of 10 persons who died allegedly of suicide, although some of them were outright murders. But they died in that facility or soon after leaving that facility because they were crippled or, you know, beaten and tortured and then died. But this was the first of these units now that are all over the country. Every state has them. Every state prison system has them. They may, or is it started as a unit in Marion, just a block of the prison. Now there are whole prison systems that are controlled unit prisons. Now, some years ago, when I had gotten out of prison, we tried to start a, well, we did start an organization, a national campaign against controlled unit prisons. And what we wanted to do was document how many of these facilities there really were at that time, you know. And we were able to find out at that stage there were 40 states that had controlled unit prisons. And then the federal government built a new controlled unit prison in Florence, Colorado. So these prisons became a means, what they were essentially is a concentration camp within the setting of prison in the United States. Now, supposedly, they tell you that you get convicted and you go to jail and then you get out in the next number of years. But these places are like perpetual imprisonment. You know, you go in and you essentially don't come out. You know, especially if you've got 20 years or 25, 30 years, you go in there and you might not ever come out. You know, they either kill you in there, they drive you insane. I mean, the conditions are so stifling. You know, you feel like you're already dead. You know, in these kinds of prisons I'm talking about. Well, this is a measure that the American government uses to silence political critics. You know, if you're identified inside the prison system as being an activist, this is the kind of repression that they put against you. And as I say, it's actually gotten worse since the time I was in there. But we were able to build a base of support on the outside that I think right now doesn't really exist. We had a grassroots movement, certainly right after the Attica Rebellion in 1971, September 1971, we had a grassroots movement in support of the prisoners. People were not as brainwashed as they are today about the prison system, about cops, and about all these other things that have gone down that has resulted in the massive imprisonment in this country. Clearly, when I was in prison, you were talking about prisoners as in the hundreds of thousands. Now we're talking about 2 million people in the county that's in the prisons. In addition to that, there are another 4 million or so, because they said there's like 6.6 or 6.7 million people prisoned under the so-called control of the criminal justice establishment, or the criminal justice state, and 3% of the population. This is a number that exceeds anywhere else in the world. This country is a nation of prisons. That's what it is. It's a nation of prisons. And they spend more money on prisons than they do on the school system, than they do on anything else, you know, for the people. Prisons have become the primary means of control. Prisons have become the primary means of economic production, actually. And I'll get to that with the so-called rise of the criminal justice complex, or the so-called industrial prison. But they found a way now to make money off prisons. They found a way now to make money off prisons. And when they find they make some money, they are going to continue to build them, and they're going to continue to put black people and poor people in them, you know. So in this period, they got what they call, for instance, the federal government has got something called a Unicor, which is Federal Prison Industries. Unicor is a corporation that makes all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't be aware of. They make the traffic signs. They make you go in a government office building or a post office, they've made most of the stuff in there, everything from the machines, you know, the snap machines to the furniture. They make clothing for the post office. They make clothing for the military. They make guided missile parts for missiles and all this kind of stuff. They make all kinds of stuff. They make 1,500 different products. And they are making hundreds of millions. I think the last count was almost $1 billion they made from prison labor. And that's just one entity. You know, that don't include the states that have got their own individual prison services where they, you know, have their own industrial complexes. That don't even include that. And they make hundreds of millions and perhaps $1 billion in this period. So that the economy has almost shifted from so-called free labor to using prison labor. And this is one of the new forms of slavery. And of course it's black people, people are calling poor people, who make up the bulk of the prison population, as it always has been. And they're making big money. They have no reason to change it. They trade, they also have the private prisons. The Corrections Corporation of America, which was started in 1986 in Nashville, Tennessee, is traded on the New York Stock Exchange and on most stock exchanges around the country. They went from just having a prison, in the hometown where I'm from, it was the first, the prison there was the first complex that they actually ran and controlled. And from that start, they now are in 8 or 9 different countries running prisons, and they are all over the country. Hundreds of thousands of people are in these private prisons. And they've spurred imitators, you know, Wachovia and the Wackenhut prison systems, and some others are now in the game as well. And they're making big money. They're also making big money. Excuse me. So what we're talking about is a prison industrial complex. This is what, you know, you hear that term, you know, thrown out there, nobody really explains what it means. It's the way they're making money off of our misery. Of course, having all these young men and young women in the prison system serving sentences means that there's going to be an impact on the communities where they're from. That means that there's not going to be anyone to raise children. That means that there's not going to be young men in the community to you know, earn money to take care of the families. It means all kinds of things. It means that the whole community is going to be dysfunctional. You know what I'm saying? The whole community is going to start deteriorating. That is exactly what has been happening. And it's interesting that we have today 2 million people in the prison system and counting. And out of that, that number, 1 million, are in fact black or African American, 1 million. And the interesting thing is that in this period, there's nobody really talking about that, and there's nobody really organizing around it, which is more important to me, is the organizing around it. And they're making money off of, I mean, you know, you got major corporations like Microsoft, we used to be Transworld Airlines, they've now been bought out by Continental, I think it is, and others. Major corporations have set up factories, called factories behind fences, inside the prison system. They've set up plants in there, and they're making money that way too. So they're making money three or four different ways. And, you know, like I said, there ain't no incentive to let you out of prison. You know, the incentive is to put you in prison, keep you there, because they make money off of you being in prison. They make money off of you being in prison. And, of course, they get political power off of you being in prison as well, because all these repressive laws, especially these repressive drug laws and all this stuff, comes as a result of the prison establishment, the creation of the prison establishment. And so this is the future. This is the present and the future of the Gap Force, you know, in terms of the prison system. Now, the curious thing about all this, like I said, is nobody's organizing around it. And what needs to really happen is, on a grassroots level, we need to have people going into the hood and organizing people around the prison system so that people understand what's happening, so they understand that they're being pimped by politicians, they're being pimped by preachers, they're being pimped by all these forces that's holding them back from understanding what's really going on. And because of this, you know, because of all this stuff happening, you got this level of poverty in the black community. You link all this stuff together. You link all the poverty, you link imprisonment, you link drugs, which the federal government actually was responsible within the community. We now know this. I had been telling somebody that stuff for years, but you know how it is, until they hear a report or something, they don't believe it. But it's the federal government from the beginning that actually used drugs at the end of the 1960s. It's a documentable fact that they used drugs as a chemical warfare weapon to beat down the black movement at the end of the 1960s. I can recall when in many cities, you know, small towns and others around the country, they didn't have heroin. They didn't want, you know, heroin is a big city problem. And but now, hell, crack is everywhere, you know. And you know, somebody come along and invent crack. We know that CIA invented crack. The CIA actually went and gave it free to dealers on the West Coast, you know, to distribute on the West Coast to start there. And we know that the federal agencies did it because they had a specific political agenda. And they've also used that as a means to strip any rights away from people in the black community, especially in poor communities, to strip any rights they have. They use it to create a paramilitary police force that can kick your door in and go in and shoot you and take you to jail or whatever, and convict you on no evidence if need be the case. I know people who have been in prison like that. And we see all this stuff happening. And the prison system is a result of that. The prison establishment is a result of that. And the same politicians who created this are the same politicians that are hollering about war now over somewhere. They want you to now. The same folks, poor folks, who have been victimized, thrown in jail, beat on the street, and all this kind of beat down. They don't even want you to go and join the military, or they're going to draft you to the military and fight wars for them, for oil in Iraq. You know, this is how all this stuff is related, it's linked. And the real important kernel of all this shit, is, if you want to look at it this way, is that ain't nobody saying nothing. You know, ain't nobody really saying nothing about this stuff. That's the scary part of it. It's like they drill people in, to be obedient, to where they will passively accept their own demise or death or whatever you want to call it. That's the trip of it. And I'm from a time, you know, when I was organizing originally as a youth, where the whole community was standing up. The whole community, not just young people, but, you know, young people primarily, but the whole community was standing up, you know. You had your Uncle Toms and all that other stuff, you know, but they were not listened to. And, you know, but what has happened now is they've co-opted so many people with money, grant money, co-opting them with political positions. And the politicians and the pimps and all these are the very people you should not listen to. You know, these are people you should not listen to. The people that they put on TV all the time, you know, and you can see them all the time on TV. First question you need to ask is, how do they do that? Because if you are really in opposition to this government and these people, you won't be really heard from like that. You know, you won't be a public figure like that. And so you ask yourself, how can they do that? They can do it because what they do is that they take these people and they define them as your leadership. They sell them to you as your leadership. They give them a national platform to speak, and their views become influential. That's how they did with Jesse Jackson, actually. Well, he's just one. I think Al Sharpton is another. I think there's a number of these people around who are really pushed forward as leadership. And what they do is they demobilize ordinary folks from getting out in the hood and doing what they need to do. And really the issue is organizing in the community. Just ordinary folks, not no special somebody, ordinary folks getting in the community, dealing with each other, talking about this stuff. It's like we having a meeting here. You go somewhere and you start talking to somebody else and you all start organizing against them. You see, somebody said, well, what is organizing? It's very simple. It's where you and others who think like you, or others that you want to think like you, things like that, you connect and you start talking about this stuff. And you go, or they go and talk to somebody else. And y'all get together and y'all start building a broader movement. You know what I'm saying? It's how things got started. People said, well, we don't have no place to meet. I know movements that have started in people's houses. Just started meeting in the house. That's all they had. You know, don't think they had to go. You start meeting in the house. But you have to do it. Now, in my situation, what I do is train youth to be community organizers. That's what I do. I recognize that the clock is ticking on me as an individual. And it's really important to pass all this accumulated knowledge and stuff, such as it is, to somebody else so that they can have it as a tool to work in this period. You know what I'm saying? You always hear, you know, about somebody manipulating somebody, youth and so on. And the reason they can do it is because they have accumulated knowledge you don't have, and they can use that against you because of your ignorance. Ignorance means lack of knowledge, is all it means. It means you're stupid or none of that. Lack of knowledge. And you can't run a game on somebody who's clearly aware. Somebody who says, well, brother, this is one brother ain't falling for what you putting down, you know, or what you manure, that manure you put down on the floor. I ain't smelling that. if you have the knowledge, if you are in a position to see shit, say, yeah, well, this is what we need to be doing. This right here is what we need to be doing. And if you have that knowledge, then it's incumbent upon you to go ahead and use that. So one of the things that I started doing was working with something in the communities I'm at now. I'm in Michigan. We got a program called Let's Organize the Hood. What we do is we train the youth, we train community people, you know, to be community organizers, to deal with the problems of their community. Nobody knows what the problems are in your community, basically, but you. Nobody knows it better than you, you know. And so if you've got some basic skills on how to do this, you know, on how to talk to folks, how to approach folks and all this, then you can start building mass movements and whatever in your own community around issues that's important to the people in that community. And you got to find out what those issues are. And the first step of any organizing is to go and talk to people and find out what the issues are that they are interested in. Not just impose your own stuff on them, because that's not long-lasting, you know. That don't empower people to organize. They don't empower people to stand up. That's short-term. They're just falling behind somebody's personality. We're talking about politically educating people, you know, going and talking to people what their issues are. Even if they come up with issues that you think are wrong, or they phrase them wrong, whatever, then that gives you an opportunity at least to tell them that and explain it to them. You might win people over that way. You won't win them first day. People won't listen to you the first day. This is a young person. They figure you don't know it as much as they do and all this kind of thing. But ultimately, if you continue doing it, you'll be able to win over a substantial part of the community to your point of view. Now, I've done this personally. It's not something that, you know, I'm just here lecturing about. I've been an organizer most of my life. As I said, I started as a youth, 10 years old, at the time of the Civil Rights Movement. I was thrown into that. But we were ultimately trained to do community organizing and to approach people and to talk about how to build movements. And we didn't have the concept of charismatic leadership. And what I'm talking about is that you just build leadership around one individual, and this person is so articulate and so forth that he can excite people. You know what I'm saying? And that's cool to a certain degree, but it's more potent to build leadership on the grassroots level than everybody's leading. You know, that potential to be a leadership. Because if they kill this one guy, as we found in the 60s, that they kill the major leaders, the national leaders, what happens then? The movement fragments and sometimes falls apart completely. So you have to build a movement that's based in the community itself, based in the people, and the people's understanding, as opposed to just one individual's understanding. You know what I'm saying? And this one individual empowers themselves many times by having the understanding and not sharing that knowledge with anybody else. Because he don't want nobody to move him, see, or hurt. So in this period right now, you know, it's really important to understand all this stuff is linked. The prison system, these same calls for war and all this stuff. And I was an organizer at the time of the Vietnam War, a youth. And one of the things, I was in the services, and I started organizing while I was in the military. And was ultimately court-martialed, put in prison, and thrown out of the military. But I learned a lot of things. You know, the movement in opposition to the Vietnam War in the military services is something that people haven't really talked about that much. But it was really broad-based. There was a worldwide movement. The American Servicemen's Union was one of them. A worldwide movement of GIs, actually, struggling against the war using all kind of techniques, including in Vietnam, blowing up their offices and shooting them in the head and all this kind of stuff on the battlefield. But people were, when they were trying in 1965 to force people to come from Germany and Korea and other places to go to Vietnam, we organized a mass campaign for people to go AWOL or to desert the army and go to another country and ask for political asylum. You see, we didn't want to be part of this bloodbath in Vietnam. This was in the early stages of the war, when they first started what they called the levy. The levy was to send all these troops there. They sent 250,000 troops in 1969, I think it was. And we were able to avoid that. And, what's our 65? 1865. And we were able to avoid this by organizing them to leave, to not become part of it, to not let yourself be killed, sit over and lick somebody's cannon fodder, because Johnson or some racist wanted war to control some other people of color. This is a racist colonial war, just like this one is coming up now. This war in Iraq is a racist colonial war. Black people have no stake in it at all. I wrote a little something called No Palestinian Call Me a Nigger. And in that, I ran it down. We ain't got a damn thing to be fighting for this country for. And poor people in this country ain't got nothing to be fighting a war for some rich man to get more money. The Bush family is rich. They're in the oil business. They're crooks. And all this is to strengthen the oil companies. Iraq is the second largest oil producer in the world. They want to, they've actually openly said it, they want to take over Iraq. Their plan is to take over Iraq, run it 10 years, 7 to 10 years, with a American military government. And then after that time, turn it over to a puppet civilian regime. That way they would take possession of this huge oil reserves. They'd be in the Middle East, really in a strong position to then push to other countries, push to take over other countries. It's important to understand this stuff, you know, because ain't nobody in the mass media telling you this. But Bush is himself saying a lot of this. I mean, a lot of this stuff is not stuff that I dreamed up. He himself has seen it, and the military is actually telling you this, well, you got to read it. Not just something to read between the lines, just read it, look at it. But they're telling you. And the Vietnam War was a similar kind of process. They passed the so-called resolution. They called it the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. They passed, I think it was in 1966, they passed that. No, 64, 65. And the Tonkin Gulf Resolution actually allowed them to attack the North. They set an incident up. They sent a one PT boat out there, which they know was going to get sunk. They sent it out there, and the PT boat shoots at the Vietnamese shoot back, sink the sucker, and they declare war. And out of that, and that's how all these people, hundreds of thousands of people, actually millions of people, including the Vietnamese, were killed as well. Millions of people were murdered in this war because of these same kind of politicians that grasped for power. And here we are back again with the same kind of situation. You know, same kind of situation back again. They want black people in jail. If they're not going to be in jail, they want them over fighting some war. They want people of color. You know what I'm saying? When I'm saying black people, I'm not just talking about African Americans. They want poor people fighting wars for this government. Or they want you in jail. Your labor is surplus. They don't need your labor anymore. They got machines that do much of the would have been manual labor. They see the black youth especially, and the youth of color, they see them as a threat to the government, a threat to state security. That's why for the last 10 or so years, they have criminalized the youth. And they've criminalized the youth because they see them to have the same potential. Fundamentally, they may not know it. You know, it's like somebody can see ahead of you because they do all this research and everything. They know your potential. And they understand that the next revolutionary movement or the next movement of resistance can come from the same kind of youth that exists today. They know that. They know they can be politically educated. They know they can be directed. They're well aware of that. And so their thing is to criminalize you. He's a thug. He's a gangbanger or whatever, you know. Need to be in the penitentiary. And they'll use any methods, you know, to do that, to railroad you to jail. Stick some drugs in your pocket, they have to. Off the jail you go, you can't prove it. You know what I'm saying? They already got you in the public imagination. You already a criminal when you walk in. Look at that, there's a criminal coming, you know. And you know, this is they brainwashed the public with that shit. So when you step in there, you're already convicted. And in the penitentiary, in the cell. So either you're gonna fight for America as part of their mercenary forces, or you're going to the penitentiary. And that's the way it is right now. So what I'm doing is just, why did they bring me here? But at any rate, I'm giving out some perspective, somebody who has been an activist. I'm not a celebrity. I'm not the kind of person that the government and the, you won't see my face on the front of some Time magazine or some bullshit like that. I'm a revolutionary. I'm not trying to save America. I'm not mourning with America. Where they, you know, the shit they do around the world, somebody, it's like a bully going around and somebody knocks the hell out of a bully. Do you feel sorry for the bully? Fuck his ass. He got what he deserved. And so I'm not somebody that, as they see it, is a person that they can negotiate with and this kind of shit. So I never, you know, I'm not one of these people they're going to put up there. There's others like me. Just people who are organizers, have been organizers for years, who have been in revolutionary movements. I was in the Black Panther Party. I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was in, you know, and I was never any leader in those things, but I was part of it. I was part of that movement that shook this country to the core. And so I've got a perspective, and it's important that, you know, you share those things that you have, that knowledge that you have, you be able to share that. That's the whole purpose. And otherwise, you can't go forward. You'll make the same damn mistakes again. I was telling, you know, some youth was asking me the other day about some organizing stuff. And I said, you know what? You all can't be allowed to make the same fucking errors we made. You know, it's criminal if you did the same bullshit we did. And you can't disrespect the so-called elders. Some of them know what the hell they're talking about, so I can understand some of that. You got to be able to think. But you can't disrespect people because they're not your age group. You know, you can't diss people for that. And sometimes they're able to give you a framework of putting stuff together that they have done or have been part of along with what's happening now. And that's real, real important, you know, to be able to look at it and say, yeah, the brother told me some bullshit about these people, so forth and so on. And you're able to look at that, because much of what they do is the same stuff. They're just repainting it, brushing it off, and selling this bullshit back to you again. You know what I'm saying? The same stuff. The same arguments about going to war. The same arguments about the prison system. The same arguments about all this stuff. You know what I'm saying? And all this stuff is linked, you know. And it's real important. Now, one thing we can't allow in this period with the anti-war movement and all this kind of stuff that's going to be developed, we cannot allow it to just be a white rights movement. In the 1960s, most of the youth in the early stages fighting against the war was white kids, white middle class kids at that, where the working class black youth didn't have any organization. One of the things that I got involved in when I came out with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, it was one of the only organizations speaking up for black youth not joining the army, actually organizing against what was going on in Vietnam and all this kind of thing, building a resistance movement and all that. And later then King himself came out against the war, and that was important. But I think that one of the most important things that happened really was when Muhammad Ali came out and spoke against the war, because he was a mass figure. He, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world, all this stuff, you know. And he was in a position to really speak to the world. He was, you know, they have taken this brother's image and pumped it so damn much. It's a disgrace. When that brother was alive and well and tough, they were scared shitless of that man. I don't mean just walking, he can walk and hit you in the mouth, but he was going to say something to embarrass the state and to make the masses rise up, you know. And when he started talking about, I'm not joining the military, ain't no Vietnamese call me a nigga, and all this kind of stuff. And I don't mean to disrespect nobody. I'm offended by that, but that's what he said. And he was saying, like, you know, why I'm going to war. What my people got to go to war for? We're going to war right here in America. that brother was bad. I'm telling you, he's a bad cat. You know, all this Uncle Tom shit I see him doing now. You know, that's the other thing I'll get. But they didn't accept him. They talked about him. They tried to starve him to death, tried to kill him, to break him down, all this kind of stuff. And but he was important in getting the youth in the black community to rise up, and even getting a segment of the black community to oppose the war. You know, there have been people in opposition, but you know, it's like one thing when you think it's just you, you know what I'm saying, and then you find that other people think the way you do, then that encourages you to really come out, you know. So people started coming out against the war in a real serious way. But the white folks in the major left organization and all that, they weren't connected to this. This was a whole different phenomenon, you know. This is a whole independent movement here, and they weren't connected to that. But there was a black power movement that came and it was connected to it, and then later there was a Black Panther Party and other organizations that even linked up with the Vietnamese people and said they were in revolutionary solidarity and actually calling for a third war in America. You know, these cats are bad. But I don't know, I just laid this out here so that we can look at this in perspective of what's happening now. It's real, real important to understand that there's not a lot of us who are willing to do anything in this period. And that those of us who are willing to do something, those of us who, once you get the knowledge, then you have that responsibility to step forward. That's always been the way I was, but you got the knowledge, you got the responsibility, you know, put it out there to make it real, make the resistance real, so that you can educate others. I think it's cool. I remember starting a black radio station in Tennessee. It was one of a number of so-called black liberation radio stations. And we used to have conscious hip hop on that station. I insisted on it, you know. And you know, it attracted a lot of youth. It got us a voice that we wouldn't have ordinarily had. Now this is an underground, so-called illegal station. The government was constantly on our ass. They threatened to seize my house. Police came by riding shotguns and all this kind of shit. If you were riding along the street, low riding some of the street, and you had that station on, they'll try to. They'll hassle your ass. They'll hassle your ass, bring you out the car, throw you on the curb, and all this other bullshit. You know, that's how bad the station was. But we talked about police like a dog, you know. Talked about this establishment, all these Uncle Tom preachers, and exposed all this stuff, graft, corruption, wasn't nothing sacred. You know, we was hitting it hard. And we was also throwing some, you know, some conscious hip hop out. Now, I wasn't programming that part of it. You know, I had some youth with me. I was programming it and everything. But it was heavy. And we were on there 24 hours a day. It wasn't just the hip hop station, we also had talk shows and all kind of stuff. But it taught me a lot about popular education and how to reach people. And if you reach people with the facts, you can turn people into a force for social change, for struggle. You can do that. And it'll miss you to that. And sometimes you learn lessons, and then in your lifespan, you have to learn them lessons again. You know what I'm saying? That's really, really important to understand that once you learn. Some people think, well, I know everything now. Ain't nothing new under the sun for me. I don't need to learn nothing else. Well, it don't go that way. As long as you're alive, you're going to learn something else, and you have to be open to learn something else. And that was one of the things that I learned, was that in this period, you can't use the same methods that you used in the 60s or you used, you know, decades before that. You got to use new means of communication, new means of delivery. You got to be able to talk to people on another level, and I respect that. And so what I started doing was taking my understanding as a trainer and organizer to put it on the radio, start talking about the prison system and how prisons were really the means. Prisons is really the low-income housing projects in this period. That's where they are. That's why we use it. Black people, poor people going into the prison system. They're the low-income housing projects. That's what they want you to be in this period. Your relationship, your whole relationship from here on out. They're putting all the money here into the prison system, all which they will use in wars this year. They bankrupted this economy with the preparations for war. Certainly starting around Reagan's time. There's no question that even to this very day, this economy is ailing from some of the military spending that Ronald Reagan did. And of course, the Bushes, you know, beat those Bushes. The Bushes are doing the same shit. They are investing heavily in military hardware and all this. Now, understand that it's not a infinite amount of money. I mean, money ain't just rolling out their ass and all that stuff. This economy is going under. They know this. They know about their serious financial problems worldwide, and part the real part of this war, and the from the standpoint of the politicians and the corporations, is that they need to take over Middle East oil. This is the beginning of an attack. It might be the beginning of World War III. I've contended that it was. It's the beginning of World War III. They need to take over Iraq. They need to take over Saudi Arabia, and they've been talking about that openly. They've been talking about overthrowing the government in Iran, Libya, all these countries. This would be the first blow. They'll see how this goes. If they just get absolute supremacy in terms of the resistance, and there's no resistance by the people, they take this country over, then there's no question that this is just going to be a number of attacks, and we're looking at the beginning of World War III. That's what we're looking at. And you can't always see it, because it's not going to develop in the precise way it developed in 1945 or 1917 or whatever, you know. It's not going to develop like that. It's going to develop along a period with the contradictions that exist right now and the problems with the United States government and Western imperialism and how they're declining. This country is in decline. This is not a country that is ascending. The economy is not ascending. This country is in decline. It has been going for quite some time from a producer nation to a consumer nation. And you go from, I remember Gil Scott Heron's song, he said, it will change your reality when you go from a producer nation to a consumer nation. And then you're at somebody else's mercy. And they are at the mercy of the oil-producing countries, have been for a while. And so that's why they're going to now outright try to take that. That's what we need to understand. You know, that's why we need to understand all this shit happening. What does this mean to those of us right on the street, in the hood, to be able to understand what the fuck is going on? What the hell is going on? Otherwise, you think it's just something some rich boy is doing, and it ain't going to affect you at all. It's going to affect you in so many different ways. Well, I don't know, I've been talking for a while, and I'm tired, and you can ask me questions, and then I can talk a little bit. I hope you got something out of it. Yeah. I wasn't all rambling. law.
Who's going to lose that?
You brought up like COINTELPRO and NHKS, and it's one thing for younger people to read about those things and try to delineate where the mistakes were. But you said in a very, you kind of made mention like, I don't want to see younger people repeat the mistakes that we made. And I think it would be good to maybe like help enumerate what those are, like from first-hand experience.
Well, I think one of the really big mistakes is, as I said, I pointed it out, was this what I call investing leadership, the power, unquestioned power. If you do that, if you make an icon of a person and put him up as the leadership of an organization, of the whole people or whatever, when that person is eliminated, the very serious possibility of a movement collapsing has to be understood. And that is what, I contend that's what's happened, what happened in the 1960s. I think even though there are organizations like the Black Panther Party around and others, COINTELPRO was a comprehensive plan to destroy primarily the Black Liberation Movement, but to destroy all the left tendencies, period, with various means. The most murderous and repressive means were for the Black Movement. There's no doubt that the Black Panther Party and other organizations on the local level, Black organizations that we may not even know about, were destroyed, the leadership assassinated. You know, I know Mr. Carl Hampton had a group called People's Party 2, which is linked with the Black Panther Party, wasn't actually I guess you could call it a pre-party formation. Of course, they heard about him and assassinated him. What I think, that's one of the things, is not to invest power in leadership. The other thing, and I see it, which needs to be reiterated, is that it's the people that actually make revolutionary change. And it's important that whatever kind of movements we build actually are in the hands of the people themselves rather than politicians or would-be politicians, rather than in the hands of leaders who have maybe their own agenda and all that kind of stuff. That's what we're seeing now. We've been living the last 30 years the result of those failures. And so the destruction of the radical wing of the Black movement, and with that, the radical wing of most people of color had similar movements. You know, you realize that you had the Brown Beret, you had the Young Lord Party, you had a succession of groups. You had a number of Asian organizations, Iwokuin, Red Guards, all kinds of groups. They were allied to the Black Panther Party, and its perspective of peoples of color being a revolutionary force. And you also had white radicals allied with that in terms of defeating racism and defeating colonialism and all this kind of thing. You know, these politics were first put forth by the Black Panther Party. And of course, what the government did is that they didn't just destroy it in terms of repression, in terms of physical repression, put you in prison, shoot you down the street and all that. They had to defeat the idea, the very idea that this should happen. We had to make a laughing stock of it, that it was beyond attainment. And many people, that's why you hear so much defeatism in this period. If you listen to some of these groups, they're so steeped in just dogma. It's like, we can't do anything. We should just give up. The police and the government are just too powerful. They should just give up. What I have seen is both the high stage of struggle, where people have built movements, man, out of nothing, and were speaking to ultimately millions of people, not only in the United States, but abroad. Those organizations like the Black Panther Party had maybe 5,000 members in its day, and yet it was, you know, in 38 chapters, and ultimately was speaking, was the main force in left movements in the United States in this period of the 66 to 72. And also influenced revolutionary politics, and was influenced by revolutionary politics around the world. Because this is also the time when you had the anti-colonial struggles going on too, where people were throwing off European rule in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And so they were linked with all of that. You know, and they had an analysis that Black people were not just fighting for some rights, civil rights, but that they were part of a struggle, international struggle for liberation, overthrow capitalism and the capitalist system. And that was a new political position at the time. So it's important to understand that they destroyed the will of people in the communities. They killed the faith people had, and they used the media to brainwash people that the idea of revolution, the idea of organizing, is ridiculous, it's impossible. When somebody says that they're a revolutionary, you should run from them, because they're just trying to get you killed. You know, people believe that shit now. It's widespread, you know, that people believe that. They may be changing, whatever, but personally, I run into that a lot, defeatism. What they did, however, basically, was to take the weaknesses of the movement itself. It was a young movement. Many of these were not veteran activists. They had never been in anything else. And they, when they made a mistake, they paid for it dearly. With somebody's life, somebody going to prison, but they paid dearly for whatever it was that error they made. So it isn't just a question of the mistakes alone. The mistakes were inevitable. You're always going to make mistakes. The thing is, if they had had a seasoned grassroots leadership, and you know, people in the hood and so forth were organized as well, so that if somebody was shot down, somebody was put in prison, others could take their place because they'd been politically educated and because they were organized and they had links in the community. I believe that the Black Panther Party would have survived, and other movements would have survived into this period and been more effective now. But they were able to wholesale wipe them out because of some of the internal contradictions. You know, but that didn't mean it's just a question alone of correct theory of, you know, it's kind of bullshit you hear. Well, if he had known that Chairman Mao had written about this, well, they'd all been saved, and we'd all been under, you know, all this kind of crazy shit. No, what it is a perspective and understanding that who makes the revolution is the people. When organizations assume it on themselves, they become vanguard organizations and push themselves out beyond the masses, so that they're no longer part of the mass movement, then I think that they would. It makes it easier for them to be destroyed. If you ask my position and others, I think that the Black Panther Party, especially, because that was the movement I was most affiliated with, I think that the Black Panther Party should have become a mass movement rather than just a political organization, a political party. I think that stage was exhausted, and they continued to with the same leadership. It should, you know, the leadership should have been changed. There should have been leadership succession. And because of some of the undemocratic stuff inside the organization that ultimately came into existence, you couldn't have a leadership change. There should have been a leadership change. And I think when you get an organization, so that's the lesson also. You get an organization and a movement, and there can't be a succession, orderly succession, or a new leadership coming into existence, and the grassroots masses having a say in what the organization does and so forth, then I think that's an organization that is vulnerable to subversion. Because what they were able to do is to take the resentment of some of the rank and file people and use it against the leadership and vice versa, and ultimately create a split. It's much more complicated than that, but that's basically it. Yeah, anyone else?
Yeah,
Oh, you got a question?
Yeah. Last night we saw, I was talking to you earlier about that Michael Moore movie, Bowling for Columbine. It's a really interesting movie because I didn't think Michael Moore would actually do this. You know, he's like, you know, whatever you want to take him for, but ultimately this movie revolved around, I mean, I think it had an analysis about gun control. And an analysis brought it back to one central issue in my mind, and that was white supremacy, the system of white supremacy in this country. But one thing he didn't touch on, he didn't tie that into, was the prison system, which I found really interesting. And you know, you talked a lot about the prison system and racism and how it's used to control communities of color, etc., etc. Can you maybe touch more about like the historical underpinnings of white supremacy?
Well, I can't talk about it as a big broad subject, maybe, if ever, but what I can say is in relation to what you're talking about, I haven't seen the movie, but, you know, one of the things, for instance, with the Black Panther Party, bearing arms was in that whole period, bearing arms was a political statement, but it also was a method of organizing. One, because it raised the issue of black people have the right to bear arms, because we're trying to prevent racist police brutality. We're trying to prevent racist attacks by the Ku Klux Klan and white paramilitary organizations, white racist paramilitary organizations. And we have the right to do it because we want to be able to build our own form of self-government, you know, in terms of that, in community control. And so it was a political concept at the time, and I think it still does have, to me, a great deal of relevancy, because I didn't see this movie, and I don't know where this guy's going. What I think, and what the arguments, for instance, around the Mulford Bill, which was when the Black Panther Party first came into existence, they used to carry weapons openly and would approach the police if they were manhandling a black person. Would approach the police, would read their rights to this brother, and have a shotgun on his shoulder or whatever, or maybe his hand, jack it right around in, whatever. And they would, take control of the situation. And so the Mulford Bill was, you know, nationally sponsored by cops and suburban whites and all this shit, were afraid of the Black Panther Party, especially if they marched on the state capitol. the discussions people were having around white supremacy and how the white racists want to disarm poor people. They never question. It's like I was having this discussion with my son. A white woman was alarmed by something I was saying. And I said, it's the open, it's violence. We want to stop violence. And blah, blah, blah. I said, you know, I think what you're telling me is that you're not worried about arms and guns in the hand of the police and the police using violence. You're worried about, as you see it, unlawful violence, or by poor people, or so-called unlawful violence by radical forces or something like that, or radical movements. That's what you're concerned about. You're concerned about your everyday life and the status quo changing so that poor people start taking the implements of weapons or whatever and use it against the status quo. So, well, if you use violent methods, you're automatically going to have a society that's violent. That's bullshit. That's nothing fundamentally beyond that. It's absolute utter bullshit. You build a new society, and people are doing it all the time. They're building new societies. They're fighting wars, liberation, and so forth. Build a new society. This country here is a bourgeois nation, and you've got people who are sucking the blood of the rest of the world. And so from their standpoint, they want the oppressed to use methods of nonviolence. They want the oppressed to use methods dictated to them by the status quo. And so when Malcolm X started talking about freedom of my enemies necessary, at the time it was extremely threatening to the white power structure, because they had succeeded to some extent of brainwashing a considerable segment with the nonviolent message of Dr. King and the Southern Civil Rights Movement. And what really alarmed them is when the youth, and see, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was a youth organization, as opposed to King's group, which is, you know, preachers, adults, and all this kind of thing. And it met with Malcolm X in Selma, Alabama. He gave a speech, talked about armed self-defense, and the use of violence in your own defense is no offense, you know. And after that, they dropped nonviolence, period. Dropped it like a hot stone, and started applying armed self-defense. They, after that, they had the situation in Mississippi, I'm sorry, in Alabama, Lyons County, and they formed their first militia in Lyons County, Alabama. So it's always been an issue. It's always been an issue. And it's a political issue. The liberals and the establishment want to disarm or the poor and make them think that they have no right to bear arms. Now, having said that, I don't necessarily approve of some crazy shit. Somebody, you know, they don't know how to use a gun and sitting up and strutting around with a gun, all this kind of macho bullshit. I'm not talking about that. You know, what I am saying is that, you know, in circumstances where the community is being attacked by racist police forces or being attacked by racist vigilante forces, that they have the right to defend themselves. They have the right to use weapons as part of the struggle to free themselves. You know, that's where I'm coming from with that. liberation. I don't necessarily agree with all kind of crazy gangster bullshit. Somebody on the street shoot some kid or some dumb stuff. I mean, you got a lot of that crazy stuff going on. That, you know, I don't approve of that. But then again, I don't approve of these cops coming down there shooting kids either. You know, so you got to really look at this in terms of political education has to go down about what, you know, what our goals and what our politics have to be, you know. Yeah.
Isn't it true that Martin Luther King himself had a small group of armed guards?
Yeah. You know, this is quite interesting that he did. Right after the, during the Montgomery bus boycott, there was attempts on his life. His property was blown up twice by Ku Klux Klansmen. One attempt almost killed his wife and baby. And he got armed forces to protect his property in Montgomery. He was criticized for it by some of the middle class establishment, you know, but he did it quite for several months, actually. And it was only after I think it fired Rustin or somebody convinced him to stop doing it, you know, because it hurt his image as a civil rights, as a pacifist and all that. But he was not a pacifist at first. He never did. He didn't apply pacifist tactics at first. And that's interesting. And, you know, even throughout his life, he had a certain concept that if you attack my home, anybody has the right to defend themselves with arms. Now, this was not put out there because they wanted to keep a certain kind of image out there, quite honest. When he went to a funeral for the brother, I can't remember his name now, he was in the NAACP in Mississippi, and he had resisted the Ku Klux Klan, had a carbine at his house. You know, carbine is like an AK-47 now, similar kind of thing. You know, this brother, he resisted. He wasn't no pacifist. He was going down shooting, and he burned the house down, and he got killed in the fire. But his family escaped. You know, and he was shooting it out with his Klansmen. There's been 30 Klansmen around his house, you know. He killed several of them. And King came to preach the funeral. And King said some stuff at that funeral that has never been published to this day, that the New York Times and all the rest of them would not publish. They suppressed it. He said that this is the way you defend your family. This is the way you can defend your home. He said this is the way ultimately we're going to have to defeat the Ku Klux Klan and other racist forces. He said we can't preach and kiss all our white brothers on the cheek that don't understand. And none of this was ever published, you know. And just the people who were there talked about it for years afterward. But so he wasn't necessarily a pacifist in all matters. You know, he did believe that when you attack my home, I've got the right to defend myself.
I was wondering about your opinions on all the anti-terrorist laws throughout the world.
Yeah.
Well, I was in Australia for a while. I heard about what happened to you. And you think that can be used kind of like another counterintelligence program?
Oh, they are. They are the counterintelligence program in this period. There's no question. You're talking about now a set of laws that have, you know, actually reincorporated COINTELPRO, which was, I said, was at that time run by the FBI, but there are parallel programs run by other agencies of the federal government to spy, to monitor, and to ultimately even assassinate and remove grassroots activists and leaders. This period, with the Anti-Terrorism Act and others, they can openly do a lot of bullshit that in those days they had to keep secret. They can openly tap your phone. They can openly follow you. They can use deadly force in circumstances now that they couldn't do back then. And they can justify everything they do by saying it's a terrorist investigation. They got a secret court. They've had a secret court for quite some time. And they would have gone even further, actually. I mean, you know, you got to realize that the so-called Patriot Act, and other things that Bush has done and openly said, for instance, he's talked about, if there's another terrorist incident, I'm going to take over the government and create a shadow government, and the people who run the government will be people who are loyal to me. Now, damn, how much, you know, blatant can you get? He said that. That's a fact. He put it in the New York Times once, put it in the USA Today, and you know, and just went right past people. Because he figures he figures that people who see shit won't believe it. They think it's a hoax or whatever. They just won't, you know, just don't factor it in. Don't process it. And he said that I'm going to run the government. He said, I've got people who are loyal to me. And hell, they're in two or three different places around Washington, D.C., and they are in bunkers and all this stuff. Now, he didn't even tell members of his own party, didn't tell none of the Congress and all these other people. He didn't tell nobody that he was doing this. And he just decided to release this information, or somebody leaked it, whatever the case may be. But, so this cat is like really making plans to run the government himself as a dictator. Of course, the USA Patriot Act allows wiretapping, it allows imprisonment without bail, it allows all kinds of stuff. And some of this stuff is actually going on right now. And if you then take it and apply it to military tribunals, when the circumstances change, if something else happens and the American people get even more scared, it's literally likely that they'll start executing people. You know, put you in prison. And that's why I was saying that it's linked. We're seeing all come home to roost, like Brother Malcolm said. Chickens coming home to roost. They built the prison system. They built these control units. They got all this repressive shit on the inside. They got all these prisoners in there. And then they turn around and they start building some military prisons. They have military prisons, you know what I'm saying? They've always had these military prisons that they had in the 1950s and 60s. They tried to, as they saw it, if they couldn't control the civil rights movement, they were going to put it all down. Kill people, take people, put them in prison, all that stuff. Nixon had a plan for that. In fact, Nixon's whole shit with Watergate was to take over the government. He tried to do what Bush is threatening to do now. Dig that shit. He tried to take over the government. They never put it in terms like that when they talked about it. Well, Nixon violated procedure and the Constitution and bloop. No, this motherfucker was going to have a coup to take the government over. That's what he wanted to do. And he didn't find the support and strength to do it. He had to back off, you know what I'm saying? Tie to it. But so this is what this cat's doing. He's taking the government. They may even manufacture insulin if they say, well, Al Qaeda ain't doing nothing. Well, what the hell are we gonna do? We'll manufacture insulin. Shit. Manufacture insulin, use that to take the government over. And institute even more repressive laws. So this shit's dangerous. It's worse than COINTELPRO. It just hasn't been used to the full extent. You also got to understand that COINTELPRO was designed to destroy existing movements that had gotten powerful. We don't have nothing like that right now. So their role is different. Their role now is to prevent anything from growing, prevent anything from starting. That's their role. So it's kind of a different thing. So they look at certain things that could give them problems. Look at the youth in the street. Get out of control. Shit, they might get organized. Might form an organization. Stop gangbanging and kill each other. Start going after federal agents. Try to overthrow the government. You know, what the fuck, you know? So they look at this shit. I'm not saying they'll succeed, though. They mean that they'll succeed. That's one of the things to bear in mind. Because these people are weakened. They're in a weakened state. And all the things they're doing, really, are things in fear. And in trying to keep the system together, it's not that everything is so powerful, the state's so powerful, and just do anything. They're trembling shitless. You know, if you hear them really talking all this bullshit, they're really trembling shitless. Well, they didn't hurt our economy. They didn't scare our people. You know, I'm not approving of, saying, somebody should come and blow up part of New York or some shit like that. I'm not saying that. But I understand why it happened. And I understand that these motherfuckers caused it to happen. It's like I wrote an article one time called Your Leaders Cannot Save You, But They Sure as Hell Can Get You Killed. And in there I talked about how this government's policies brought on this attack. And it'll probably bring on more shit. And frankly, it amazes me that it didn't happen long before now. All the bullshit they've done around the world, all the people they've gotten killed, So these laws are passed. Yeah, they're much more devastating than the COINTELPRO. They've got much more power right now than COINTELPRO ever had.
can you talk at all about what happened in Australia?
When in Australia, there was a right-wing organization and a politician named Pauline Hanson. Well, there had been these struggles between the right-wing and the Aborigine movement and the anti-colonial societies. The anti-colonial society is similar to an anti-racist movement. And the Aboriginal peoples, and the so-called indigenous people were struggling against them stealing even more land. Actually, they're demanding that they give land back. And essentially, reparations. They're asking for reparations. This is what they're asking for. And the role of the line of this politician was, not only should they not get anything, but they should be wiped out, finish wiping their ass out and all this kind of shit. So they called for an international boycott of the 1996 games. I went there in the 2000 games. I went there in 97. I had been one of the organizers of the protests at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and they knew that, and I was invited and so forth. I had been writing people for years anyway from the time I was in prison in Australia. So I go in 1997, and you know, the anarchists and the Aboriginals and all these people invited me. I go there in July of 97. And when I get there, I walk in the middle of this, you know, political storm that was going on, and I got made into a symbol by the right wing. They put pressure out saying that I snuck into the country and I had guns and I was a terrorist and I was doing this and that and all this shit. Well, there wasn't a specific law that they used to put me in jail. Frankly, they ultimately arrested me. But there wasn't a specific law, which is why they ultimately had to release me. What they were doing was just pandering to the right, you know. This government was a conservative government, but the so-called One Nation Party, which is what Pauline Hanson was from, was an outright fascist organization.
Yeah.
Outright fascist organization. They were working with the Ku Klux Klan of Australia. Now, dig this shit. Up in northern Queensland State, which is where Brisbane is, there was a small town there where the Ku Klux Klan suddenly appeared with automatic weapons and all these transport tanks and all this other bullshit, and started shooting and beating black people up there, you know, and other folks to, you know, stand up. And so all this stuff was going on, and Hanson was involved in all this shit. There were some of the people up there. It was this racist paramilitary organization. I can't think of the name of it right now.
National Action?
It may have been.
Yeah, I ran into them.
But, so all this stuff was going on, and she used me as a scapegoat in the media and everything. She always got massive media attention. But what she didn't expect is I would turn around and use the shit back, you know, and all this. And even though I got arrested and all that, I was still raising hell on the inside and stuff. They beat the fucking hell out of me. They tried to kill me in there, I think. They beat me unmercifully. They, you know, broke my glasses off in the face and, you know, punched me and all this kind of shit, dragged me by the handcuffs all over the compound and all sort of bullshit. I just threw me in a patrol unit. The prison was run by an American company. Wackenhut. The personnel were Australian, but it was an American prison. They paid the bills. And I'm in there, man, they were had me all fucking handcuffed the first day. And somebody managed to get word out. Well, what happened is they had so many Aboriginal youth in there, and they were demanding that I be released, because they said, well, you know, like they thought I was going to get killed. And I put it out in the media and said, you know, that I thought he was going to kill me. And they threatened to burn the damn prison down. They helped bring me out of it. They had the young brothers all lined up, and you know, had some other folks with them, lined up, and they demanded that they bring me out of this damn unit to show that I was not, you know, dead, or I, you know, had my legs broken and shit, and scared the fucking officials to death. You know, because the thing is, even though the prison officials, you know, control the premises, they don't control the prison. You know, they don't really control the prison. And these prisoners were pissed. They were going to burn the place down if they didn't allow me out. So they let me out and all this shit. Yeah, my case was the Supreme Court of Australia, equivalent high court.
Yeah.
And it made legal history. You know, I was ordered, they ordered me back into the society, said I didn't receive a thing called natural justice, which is the same as due process of law. I didn't receive it, you know, they just railroaded me to jail without hearing, which is true. They even threatened to arrest my attorneys when I was arrested and placed in this detention facility. And I went back on the tour and talked about the government and all this shit. Now, the secret police there is called the ACO, the Australian Secret Intelligence Organization. And these motherfuckers were treacherous. They were treacherous. They threatened to kill me. You know, they were going to use either Nazis to do it. You know, in fact, we knew about that. We had armed security in most of the places I spoke after that. I even had some Americans living over there. One or two brothers were living over there. They were part of my security force. But we had, they were threatening to kill me. You know, the Nazis were, and the secret police were pissed off because they had been embarrassed because I brought out that, you know, they beat me up and all this shit and all that. And I, you know, because the people were angry at them. Like to cause a riot in Brisbane, they ran into the Supreme Court hearings and, you know, was going to take over the building if they hadn't heard my case. They had fucked them up. They heard my case. Plus, around the world, they thought I was by myself. And around the world, there were groups of people had demonstrations in the United States and 17 other countries. You know, and that fucked them up, you know. So it was a big deal, you know. And they heard got my ass out of there. You know, eventually I left. Now they banned me after I left, you know. I can't come back here. Yeah, shit. These folks are treacherous, man. They're treacherous. But these black people in Australia are highly conscious. Especially in the back, in what we call the outback, many of them have armed self-defense units and shit. They've been fighting a land war against the mining companies that have been trying to take over the land, and several miners and them have been killed. This has been going on for years. Literally, a guerrilla war has been going on there. You know, the people don't even know it. You don't even know anything about it unless you go to, you know, Australian fan, I hear about this. I would have known about the Ku Klux Klan that I went there, you know. So I don't tell them. Had pictures of them. And ultimately, you know, the black people start fighting back. You know, and that broke a lot of that bullshit up. They went to some place, somebody tricked them into some damn place, they come strutting over in there, they lit their ass up like a firecracker. Beat the hell out of them, shot some of them, all kinds of shit. Again, I was Hanson blamed me for that. I'm way over in the United States. It's all the fault of Lorenzo Irvin. He's the one who had something to do with this shit. You know, like he gave him the guns. So. That's crazy shit. Yeah. That was deep. I gotta write about that. So when I get my book out, you will be. Anyone else? Well, thank y'all for coming. A new copy of Anarchism and the Black Revolution.
Yeah, if anybody's interested in doing a study group on Anarchism and the Black Revolution,
Volume 2 there, or somebody.
There's a list. I'll leave it up by the templates. Or if you want any further information about it, stuff like that, put your name, email, phone, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was a book I started writing, in fact, when I was in prison in Marion, Illinois, in the patrol unit myself, and started writing that book then, smuggled it out, and had it published as a pamphlet in 1979. I didn't get out to 1983, or last part of 1983. And it's had quite an impact. It amazes me how much the impact it's had. It's taken me all over the world. Essentially, you know, everybody should think of. And it's, you know, I guess I'm not a celebrity, but for those people who are activists and, you know, are sympathetic to anarchism and so forth, a lot of people have read it. You know, a lot of people of color are starting to read it as well, which really surprised me how many had, you know. And there are not a lot of revolutionary voices in this period. That's one reason, I think. I really do believe that. many people who they put forward as leadership and all that, and I'm not trying to be a leader or anything, impression, but many of the people who they push forward as leadership are really people who are on the take in many ways, you know. If you look at this way, if you fight the government and all this other bullshit, you think you're going to be living in a mansion and all that kind of shit? And riding around a limousine and all this kind of bullshit? You know, does that make you at least bit suspicious? You know, you fighting these people, and you riding around a limousine and all this other bullshit. Something, that would make me think something wrong here. You know, all these people, poor people in this period, there are more people in poverty today than any time in history. I mean, I'm including the 1930s. 1930s is what shit period was happening right now. You know, when I was coming up in the 60s and 50s, you didn't have any homeless people sleeping in the goddamn street, millions of people. I'm not saying there wasn't no poor people, but they weren't impoverished like they are today. What has happened is that this economy has deteriorated, and the economic basis transformed from industrial labor, where people in the inner city could get decent jobs, to now it's all service and technological jobs, and they don't pay shit. You have to get 2 or 3 jobs just to make a decent living, if you can get the decent jobs in the inner city. And so the youth got to survive the best way they can. You know, I'm not encouraging nobody to get out and do no wrong or no illegal bullshit, but I'm saying, you know, people got to do what they see, you know, fit to survive. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but there it is. And so they're creating these class of prisons. This is where I'm getting at. That's where I'm going with this. You know what I'm saying? Like, the government's creating its own class of prisoners. In the 1960s, we went to prison for political reasons. In this period, people are going to prison for economic reasons and political reasons or someone else. They're going to prison nevertheless. A lot of people don't know why they're in prison. Ain't nobody around to really politically educate them while they're in prison. Ain't nobody sure as hell in prison to teach them how to come out and be something different from what they went in. You know, and you know, that's really the real relevance of Malcolm X's story. Is that how he became transformed into something else, someone else, and how basically anybody can do that, you know, could be that same person, you know, and that's real important, because there's people who think, well, I got this education, I've got this, I got that, I know all this, I know all that, must be something special about me. Really ain't nothing special about you, because if somebody else had the same shit you got, or even with less, to become a better person and more able to shape the world up than you are. You know, so that's really, really important to understand. Real important. I don't know how long I'll be on the scene in this period. I'm 55 years old now. You know, the clock is ticking. But my commitment is, you know, as long as I'm healthy and as long as I'm able to speak, you know, speaking tonight, you know, simple speaking. As long as I'm able to do this, it's important to talk to people. Because even though I'm not televised and talking to millions, the people who I'm talking to, perhaps they are the people who are most willing to go out and do something. You know, that's really important to understand. Somebody had to influence me. You know what I'm saying? That's a fact. You know, somebody or something influences people to do shit and to be who they really are. You know what I'm saying? For me, you know, it was the whole period of the sit-ins and the civil rights and all that stuff, and later the Black Power movement and all that. Those things were so prevalent that they influenced a whole generation, especially young Black activists. But after this period, young people period, whole generation. And you don't have that right now. You know, you got people who learn shit, but they don't do shit. And that's criminal. Not because you're sitting on your ass doing nothing, but you have the ability to do more. I'm not saying just get out and make some money or some bullshit or just make a living, but make a way for people in your community you know, make a way for your people who are oppressed. That's what I'm talking about. And you don't have very many people talking about that. They don't talk about that. They wait on a crisis where somebody gets shot or some other bullshit, then they want to get out and profile over that. You know. So we want to be organizing every day. Let's organize the hood. The concept is to organize every day. It ain't just organize when somebody gets shot. It ain't just in response to some other bullshit. You know, these people run a system. Got black folks and poor folks in prison every day. Putting somebody in there every day. So we got to be doing some stuff in the streets to really create a survival program so people can come out and live in the streets decently and try to transform this whole society. That's what this is about. The soapbox is off. Anybody want to get on the soapbox? You can get on the soapbox. Thanks for coming, y'all.
Thank you very much.
Well,
thank you, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I sure did. I think it's in the phone.